You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, is your Mac computer running slower than usual? Well, if it's a year old, then it's already filled with junk that's slowing it down. Thankfully, there's a safe, free download called FreshMac. Designed to scan, clean, and optimize your Mac computer, FreshMac can speed up your Mac and free up hard space in minutes. That's right, its one-click scan can tell you what's clogging up your Mac in just 60 seconds. So freshen up your Mac and go to FreshMac.com to download FreshMac for free now. That's FreshMac.com. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi there, I'm Ben Mathis and welcome to Kick-Ass News. In the not-too-distant future, we'll be plugging our brains into the internet, replacing our worn-out body parts, and eating meat that was grown in a lab. If we're lucky, we'll be living in a world of more productivity, more energy, and more equality. And if we're not, we'll be facing the profound threat of non-existent privacy, ecological collapse, and nuclear proliferation. Of course, we can't know the future for certain, but a new book called Megatech, Technology in 2050, is a mind-clearing guide to the possibilities. In this bold new book, the executive editor of The Economist, Daniel Franklin, brings together today's most innovative scientists, leaders, thinkers, and writers to imagine how future technology will develop and shape our lives. Daniel Franklin has been executive editor at The Economist since 2006 and editor since 2003 of The Economist's annual publication, The World In, a collection of predictions that identifies and explores the issues that will shape the year ahead. Mr. Franklin joined The Economist in 1983 to write about Soviet and East European affairs. As the newspaper's Europe editor from 1986 to 1992, he covered the great European upheavals from the collapse of communism to the signing of the Maastricht Treaty. After a stint as the Britain editor, he moved to the United States as Washington bureau chief covering the first Clinton term. In 1997, he moved back to London as editorial director of the Economist Intelligence Unit. From 2006 to 2010, he was editor-in-chief of Economist.com, and for the following 4 years, he was business affairs editor, running the paper's coverage of business, finance, science, and technology. In 2012, he published an eye-opening book called Mega Change, The World in 2050, which guides readers through the sweeping, fundamental trends changing the world in the coming decades. Now he's followed it up with a new book, Megatech, Technology in 2050, which focuses specifically on the tech trends. Today, Daniel Franklin will talk about Megatech, including the best ways to predict tech trends, which sector will benefit the most from technology in the 21st century, and why some are predicting that Moore's Law may finally be running out of steam. He'll reveal how 3D printing may bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S., how your next car might be sewn together, and why Google Glasses might be poised to make a comeback. Plus, Daniel Franklin talks about covering the fall of the Soviet Union in the 1980s and Vladimir Putin's update of KGB-era tactics, how his three decades at The Economist have shaped his worldview, and what he sees as the role of the magazine that extols globalism, free trade, and immigration in the face of the world's current populist revolt. Coming up with The Economist's Daniel Franklin in just a moment. Daniel Franklin has been executive editor of The Economist since 2006 and editor since 2003 of The Economist's annual publication The World In, which focuses on the year ahead. His book on long-term trends, Mega Change, The World in 2050, came out in 2012. Daniel Franklin and the team at The Economist have now followed it up with a new book looking ahead at tech trends called Megatech, Technology in 2050. Daniel Franklin, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, before we get into the new book, you've been at The Economist for quite a while. I believe you've been there since 1983. I'd be curious, how has your worldview changed, or has it changed much since you first came to The Economist?
Well, I think a lot has remained very much constant. I mean, my own views and the fundamental, I suppose, philosophy of The Economist has remained remarkably unchanged, not just since I've been there, but since it was founded in 1843 to campaign against the protectionist corn laws. And it turns out we now have to campaign against protectionist politicians again in the United States and beyond. So a lot remains unchanged. But the world, of course, has been through enormous change. And I've been fortunate enough to be part of the Economist coverage of momentous changes such as the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Soviet Union, and then of course financial crises and extraordinary rise of China. So the absolutely momentous changes in the world, and of course great technological change as well.
And the mission statement of The Economist since it was founded in 1843 is to take part in, quote, a severe contest between intelligence, which presses forward, and an unworthy, timid ignorance obstructing progress. Looking at the events of the past year, do you have any concerns that you might be losing that battle?
Well, I think the point about that battle is that it does never end. And it would be, of course, wrong to pretend that there aren't setbacks. And I think the past year provided some significant setbacks. But I don't think I think that makes it all the more important. And I think it energizes a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues in The Economist and actually in other publications as well, to believe that this sort of argument of putting the case for often what seem to be not the most popular policies, but the ones that we believe in, is very important. And to make difficult arguments and put the case succinctly and as clearly as possible, that mission turns out to be as relevant today as it was in 1843.
And I don't think that I'm revealing any secrets here when I say that The Economist tends to take a positive view of things like globalism, free trade, immigration, greater connectivity. Do you find it hard not to take it a little personally when you see this emerging populist nationalist movement rejecting many of the fundamental values your magazine was founded on?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily surprising that people object. They always have done. There's always the forces against such ideas and the immediate attractions, the narrow attractions of more protectionism, more closer national identity is actually very understandable. And the I suppose the challenge for us is to patiently explain again and again why it's actually in the greater interests, ultimately, even of the people who are attracted by such policies, to have the more open world that we argue works most effectively and leads to greater human welfare over time.
You began your career at The Economist covering Soviet and East European affairs. You covered the fall of the Soviet Union. Throughout that era and beyond that, Russia has had a long history of meddling in elections within its sphere of influence. Were you surprised by the brazenness with which Russia applied these same tactics to a U.S. presidential election? And what do you think it all means?
I suppose I'm not surprised by the brazenness. I'm surprised by the effectiveness of it. I'm not saying that it necessarily swung the result, but it certainly didn't hurt. Surprisingly successful in inserting ideas and themes into the election campaign, using some fairly traditional propaganda tools, but with the twist that it was using new technology to make them work and spread faster and more effectively.
Having covered the Soviet Union in the 80s, do you feel any bit of deja vu?
Yes, but then I felt deja vu even in the covering the Soviet regime with older themes of Russia. I remember one of the earlier pieces I wrote for The Economist went way back to the early Western travelers to Russia and the sorts of things they found in Tsarist Russia. And you find remarkably similar themes preceding even the communist era, the types of mystique of Russia and the obsessions or the preoccupations of Russia compared with Western views and so on. There's a lot more continuity than I think people realize between these long traditions and the particular political regime in any given period.
Well, this new book is called Megatech, and it's sort of a sequel to your book Megachange, which talked about the fundamental trends shaping the 21st century. That book came out almost 5 years ago. A lot has happened since then. The war in Syria, Russia's annexation of Crimea, Brexit, this larger populist trend, not to mention the election of Donald Trump. In the time since Mega Change was published in 2012, have you identified any new trends that we want to keep our eye on?
Well, I think you've described some pretty important ones that certainly have emerged and that would certainly, if we wrote the book today, we'd, I suppose, emphasize that more, although I think they were to some extent already visible. But really what this focus on 2050 tries to do is to move beyond the things that are just happening over a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 year period and look at the real shifting tectonic plates. So you look, for example, at the really profound changes in population trends, the aging of the population, how many people we'll have on the planet, the urbanization that is proceeding apace, where the people are going to be, where the young people are going to be compared with where the aging workforce is going to be. You know, that's just the population end of it, but you can push those trends out, not with absolute 100% certainty, but with a fairly good idea of broad trends out a number of decades, and you get a very vivid and mind-concentrating picture of the sorts of issues that we're going to be grappling with in the decades ahead. So that was the idea behind Make a Change, and now the idea is to follow up with a very focused look at the technology side of things, which is, of course, hugely influential in any number of spheres.
Yeah, and I think that you say that it covers much broader issues because in the coming decades, tech will be almost pervasive throughout our lives in every aspect.
Yes, I think there's a couple of sort of, I think, broad, across-the-board themes that emerge from it. That's one of them, that, you know, every industry is a technology industry, really is. And the second theme is that it's tending to move faster. So there's for a number of reasons, I think, a sense that things are speeding up and therefore we're entering into a period over the next 30 years where tech change will just be probably extraordinarily rapid and very exciting, but also raising issues that we're also going to have to get our minds around fairly swiftly.
Why did you choose the year 2050 in both of these books? Is it just a nice round number, or is there a particular significance to the half century mark?
Well, it is a bit of a nice round number, and it's a bit of a metaphor, really, to say think beyond the sorts of horizon that people normally think, mm-hmm. to stretch things out, stretch your thinking. You know, people are pretty good at, and I do this every year with my publication, The World In, you know, thinking what's going to be happening next year, perhaps even what's going to be happening 5 years out, but thinking, you know, a generation or a bit more ahead, that really forces you to say, well, let's think differently about what we expect to be coming. Let's really stretch our minds. And I think when you do that, you find that you see the present in a sense a bit more clearly as a result.
Megatech is a collection of essays from a very diverse range of writers, including economists and futurologists to philanthropists and even sci-fi writers. How did you go about deciding who to include in this book?
Yeah, well, unlike Mega Change, which was mainly from our own economist writers, this was about half and half. Half of them are my economist colleagues, and I would have been downright stupid not to go to the people who are working in the offices down the corridor, who are extremely brilliant and have great insights into many of these issues. So that was an obvious first place to turn. But I felt with this book, because of the quite specialized nature of some areas of technology and the need to have a broadening of perspectives, it was important to go outside as well. So it is a very varied group. I wanted to ask some scientists where they thought the state of their science had reached and what it would imply over the coming decades for the possibilities in technology. We've even included, as you would have seen, a couple of science fiction writers to provide us with imagined futures in 2050, which I think is important because they can both take to the logical conclusions where technology may lead and also explore a bit more some of the ethical questions that will arise as technology pushes boundaries.
The first section of Megatech lays out what you call a toolkit for predicting future technology. What are the main tools there?
Well, three main tools, actually. And this is my colleague, Tom Standage, who's brilliant at looking at tech trends. And he finds it very useful to start with looking at the past. There are patterns in the development of technology in the past that can be quite revealing about how things may develop in the future. Tom wrote an entire book on the Victorian internet, as he called it, which was, of course, the electric telegraph. And there were many parallels between the way that developed and the way the internet today has developed. You can see that there are lessons to be learned in the switch from horse-drawn carriages to automotive vehicles. Many of the same issues that we worry about today were grappled with then. You know, what happens with this whole industry of people that are employed in the, let alone the horses, in maintaining that industry? How safe will it be? People used to walk in front of cars in the early years with waving flags because they were worries about safety. How do you build all the infrastructure for it, and so on? So there's the past can be tremendously helpful to see, you know, what are the sorts of patterns you might expect when a new technology emerges. Then there's the present, which is you seek out the places where you can catch a glimpse of the tech future and technologies that have arrived early somewhere or that are being observed or being adopted enthusiastically. You know, there's this quote, famous quote from William Gibson, "The future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed." So the idea is that technologies don't arrive overnight. They typically take several years of gestation. So if you know where to look, you can see tomorrow's technology in play somewhere today. And then the third piece of the toolkit is science fiction. As I said, it can be very instructive as playing out to the nth degree what happens when a particular technology takes off. It can also provide something of a roadmap to technologists who maybe or often are sci-fi addicts themselves and set about creating in practice what they've seen in the film or read in the book.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that middle tool because you say that it's often a very niche group or demographic that is an early adopter of certain technologies. What would be a good example of that?
Yeah, and you have to start by saying, of course, this is difficult stuff. You may pick on the wrong one. Trend spotting is hard. A lot of people are trying to do it, and you can find the wrong one. But a good example might be in the early part of this century, Japan had a very sort of enclosed telecoms infrastructure. So they started doing things with their phones that weren't being done anywhere else. And you started seeing features appearing on Japanese phones that weren't available in America yet or in Europe. And you could see that the phone was becoming a much more widely used tool than just something that people would use for talking. And so people started to look at what the Japanese were doing with their phones, in particular Japanese schoolgirls, who were the most avid users of these possibilities. And I think Wired magazine even had a column called Japanese Schoolgirl Watch, which was premised on the idea that you look at today at what Japanese schoolgirls are doing to see what other people will be doing out in the rest of the world tomorrow. And then, of course, some years later, smartphones took off elsewhere. And it does turn out that the phone is the very handy material of technology of choice for where we more or less can have all our knowledge and conduct much of our business.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Daniel Franklin, executive editor at The Economist, when we come back in just a moment. You know, folks, I'm not exactly a gourmet cook, but one thing I've come to realize is not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference, so it's important to know where your food comes from. Thankfully, for less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers delicious, quality food courtesy of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S. right to your door, supporting a more sustainable food system and setting the highest standards for ingredients. Plus, with Blue Apron's freshness guarantee, you can be sure that every ingredient in your delivery will arrive ready to cook or they'll make it right. It's no wonder that they're the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. I've become a huge fan of Blue Apron. It's easy to prepare, it's delicious, and it's always something new. Like just this past weekend, we made their Top Chef spice-rubbed pork with sweet red onion and black beans. Man, oh man, was it good. And some of the meals I'm looking forward to in April include spinach and fresh mozzarella pizza with olives, bell peppers, and ricotta salata, sweet and sour salmon with bok choy, carrot, and ginger fried rice, Parmesan-crusted chicken with creamy fettuccine and roasted broccoli, and baby broccoli and fontina paninis with hard-boiled egg and arugula salad. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/kick. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/kick. Blue Apron. A better way to cook. And now, back to the podcast. In the first section of the book, Tim Cross, the Economist science and tech editor, suggests that Moore's Law is running out of steam. Now, on the face of it, that would seem to put a damper on all of this tech enthusiasm, but he says tech progress will chug along in spite of this slowdown. Why is that?
Well, first of all, Moore's Law, which is basically the rule of thumb that has said that the efficiency of semiconductors and improves exponentially and the price comes down relentlessly. And that has held true for a remarkable number of years and has meant that we can have this incredible computing revolution whereby we have enormous computing power in our pockets. And you can miniaturize in an amazing way, and you can make it accessible to everybody. But there does come a time when you can no longer make something ever smaller. You reach the limits of atomic size. There's probably a little bit of road to go, but it's very expensive to eke out another doubling of efficiency and so on. So it'll get harder in future, and it'll be probably less metronomically dependable. The great thing about Moore's Law was that an entire industry could really assume that the next great leap in efficiency was only a couple of years away. That was incredible. Now, the improvements in efficiency will have to come through probably a mix of means and won't be quite as dependable. But crucially, it will be possible. This is what Tim argues. And because a lot of the technologies that are talked about elsewhere in the book really rely on massive amounts of computing power, huge amounts of data, for example, embedded in everything, lots of processing power applied to industries which in the past haven't needed so much, such as medical technology or even farming, the law, education, you name it. These things are all going to be very data dependent. So we're going to have to find other means to eke out efficiency to provide that. And you know about computing in the cloud. That's one important thing. There are probably improvements in software that can help. And then in the future, there are technologies such as quantum computing, which are really mind-bending, that will come into practical use and probably provide whole new exciting developments for computing.
Yeah, and you mentioned farming. It may come as a surprise to many readers that that is the industry that the book says will be most transformed by technology. What can we look for there?
Well, first of all, it's a fairly fundamental one, obviously, because right. 2050 we'll have about 10 billion people. The first question you might want to ask is, can we feed them? And the answer, at least providing the book, is yes, absolutely. The signs are quite good through a combination of much more efficient current methods of farming and whole new types of farming that are likely to come into view in this sort of timescale. So the current methods, again, I mentioned big data. You will increasingly see data sensors telling the farmer pretty much down to the square inch, you know, when to plant, how much water to add to the soil, when it should be fertilized, when it should be, plant should be harvested, and so on. So that can provide terrific efficiency gains. So can the gains from gene editing that will enable crop varieties to be created that are much more resilient and efficient. And possibly even new types of enhanced photosynthesis that will make plants grow faster. So all these methods can make existing farming much more efficient. There are great gains, of course, from applying existing technology to parts of the world that haven't benefited from them yet. So providing more tools in the hands of farmers in the emerging world can make a big difference. But then there's the sort of futuristic farming. Vertical farms in urban areas, which are dark spaces where there's no natural light, but it relies on using every photon carefully calibrated and using hydroponic methods to grow vegetables, say, for consumption close to the farm. You can imagine even meat grown from cell culture, not from live animals, and other types of products such as dairy products that might be produced in that way for raw materials. So you can see a whole different sort of farming industry emerging, possibly raising questions about, you know, whether these are the types of food that people are comfortable eating. But then again, other people will be very happy that if you don't have to kill animals to eat meat, that might be a great thing.
And Anne Schuchat writes an interesting article in which she predicts an energy abundance by 2050. What's going to drive this turning point for renewable resources?
Well, it's another of these areas where you're starting to see these exponential rates of progress. So solar power, which had to rely on very substantial government subsidies to get it going because it wasn't competitive with much more efficient fossil fuels. Now it's getting to the stage where it is getting dramatically more competitive and in some cases can stand on its own two feet without subsidy. And it will get more and more effective and will be possibly also in the future using new types of materials that could enable it to have applications beyond the sort of solar panels we see now, maybe in materials that can be spread onto more or less anything, transparent films that would perhaps eventually enable you to wear the technology. Doesn't seem very long time ago we were all worried about energy scarcity and peak oil, and now we're almost worried that there's there's almost too much cheap energy that will create a problem of having the incentives to create energy that we can use when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing.
Yeah, and a key part of this is you talk about how it's going to affect manufacturing. Your innovation editor at The Economist uses the example of BMW's i3 electric car to show how manufacturing can become dramatically more efficient. What's the difference between how the i3 is made and how, for instance, a Ford Taurus is made?
It's a lovely example. It really does seem like a sort of glimpse into the future. So that is, you know, the traditional way of producing a car is to bash it out of steel. This is using techniques that you might recognize more from a textile factory. It's actually weaving the body of the car together through clever use of synthetic material, carbon fiber. And the result is much less use of water, less use of electricity than would be the case in the traditional way of making such a car, and probably use of clever materials can also get you lighter and perhaps even more aerodynamically effective materials and so on. So new production techniques and new materials in particular, there's talks of really a new era where you create many materials that have never existed before and can start to even design materials to order rather than trial and error. You more or less say, I want a material of this property, and you can set about starting to produce it. Paul Marchilli, who writes this chapter, says something very intriguing at the end, which is fascinating, that the great entrepreneurs of the future will be making things. So one thinks of the big entrepreneurs, or many of the big entrepreneurs of recent times, of having been involved in the software industry or in services of one sort or another. Think of Facebook or Google or Microsoft. Making things will be, and you can see perhaps Elon Musk is an example of someone who is making things and whose car company has just surpassed Ford in its market capitalization. So you can see that sort of starting to come into view already.
Yeah, and one bright spot for U.S. labor is you have an essay detailing how 3D printing will cause a lot of manufacturing that went offshore to come home. My question to you is, if we have 3D printing technology, won't countries like China and Vietnam have the same technology and still be able to make those materials and parts even cheaper?
Well, they will. They do. I mean, the China, for example, is investing very heavily in robots for manufacture. China is also investing very heavily in 3D printing. In fact, there's a Chinese company that's even printing homes. So apparently a giant machine that looks a little bit like a giant sort of machine that you use to ice a cake is pressing out actual units for housing. So yes, China will not go away as a manufacturing center, but I think it means that if you have an advantage in materials, in the materials science, and you are good at that, and you can invest in the 3D printing machines, there's no reason why. In fact, there's reason why you would want to manufacture that where the skills are and where the customers are. And increasingly, that may well be close to the markets that are consuming the products. And that could well be in, you know, more than has been the case in recent years in the United States or in Western Europe, where there are these sophisticated technologies available. So it doesn't mean that China goes away as a manufacturing center, but it means that I think there can be much greater competitiveness in other parts of the world as well.
The book argues that the trickiest adjustment of all is the way we manage new technologies alongside labor markets and pay earned by workers. How do you do that if there just aren't as many jobs due to AI and robotics?
The answer to that is partly a timing one. It's a very tricky problem. But when you say there aren't as many jobs, I think eventually, in all likelihood, there may well be as many jobs. It's not as if the type of jobs we do is set in stone and we don't invent new ones. We do invent new ones. But in fact, we're very good at inventing new ones. Most people today do jobs that nobody could have imagined doing, you know, before the Industrial Revolution. So we do create new services that use skills creatively. We do create new needs, and we'll no doubt find new ways of working alongside machines in innovative ways. The problem is we won't necessarily do that at the same rate that the old jobs are pushed aside, mm-hmm. Or that the people who are pushed aside may not have the types of skills that are needed in the new economy. So I think there is a genuine problem there of possibly rather a long transition where we're moving over to a very different type of labor force working along with very sophisticated machines. Mm-hmm. And how we handle that is, I think, going to be one of the big challenges of public policy. And that's why people are thinking of solutions. I'm not sure I would go along with this, but universal basic income as something that might handle the transition. And we're certainly mm-hmm. going to have to give a lot more thought to the sorts of skills and the sorts of flexibility that the workforce of the future will need to adapt to this world.
The book ends with a look at the fears that people had at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. Now, many futurists and tech thought leaders say that due to robotics and artificial intelligence, the next wave is going to be so radically different from any of the technological upheavals that preceded it that the old rules of creative destruction may not apply. And some might even say that comparing the Industrial Revolution with what's coming in this next chapter is a little bit like comparing a Bronze Age sword to a nuclear missile. What do you think might be applicable here? And do you consider this chapter about the Industrial Revolution a glimmer of hope or a dire warning?
Well, the concluding chapter, which does look back to the Industrial Revolution, is not, I wouldn't say it was entirely reassuring. I think it's making a rather sobering point that one of the things that you can expect is that technology will have unintended consequences. It really tends to do that, and particularly when it's moving at speed. And some of the things that we're grappling with today, such as, you know, carbon in the atmosphere, or we grappled with hole in the ozone layer, these were results of things that people didn't dream were going to be problems when they set about, inventing the steam engine or refrigeration chemicals that ended up creating an ozone problem. And then you have to start dealing with that problem. And we're today dealing with problems of computer security, cybersecurity, that perhaps we should have thought more about in advance of digitizing like mad. But that wasn't really so much on the radar screen until we suddenly realized, actually, we've got a big problem on our hands. And you mentioned, the other manifestations of this in the political sphere as well.
Well, the book presents an interesting tug of war between people such as economist and so-called pessimist Robert Gordon, who argues that digital technology could actually lead to greater inequality, and those who take a more bullish view of the future, like Melinda Gates, who predicts that technology will actually have a democratizing effect. What is your personal view? Do you tend to err on the side of optimism or pessimism?
Well, I think there's that fundamental tension that runs through the books. It's not something I, again, particularly, coordinated between the various contributors. It's something that it just exists. And often within a chapter, there will be a sense of the excitement of what's on offer, while at the same time saying, well, be careful, because this poses some problems that we're going to have to handle down the road. There's no room here, I don't think, for complacency, but there is room for a lot of excitement about the sorts of enhancement of human welfare and human possibilities that technology can bring.
Before we sign off here, I was interested to read an article by your news editor, Leo Morani, in which he predicts that augmented reality glasses will replace smartphones. Now, hasn't the public already rejected that idea with the Google glasses?
Well, I think Google glasses are one example of the sort of the early version of this that didn't live up to the hype, and people quickly rejected them. But I don't think that means that they're going away. I think, on the contrary, people will come back and there'll be better designs for this. Already you can see, I think, versions of this type of technology, augmented reality capacity, that is proving very effective in industrial settings, in improving productivity, and the sort of utility value of it will only be improved as companies develop smarter versions of it. And I think, crucially, versions that that look quite convenient to wear and quite cool to wear, not something that you might be embarrassed to put on.
Yeah, the futurist Michio Kaku once told me that they may even have contact lenses with computers in them by then.
I think there's patents out on those already.
So, really?
You know, that's, wow. That's, you know, very real prospects.
Well, I guess we'll have to talk in another 5 years and see where we stand. The book is called Megatech, Technology in 2050. Daniel Franklin, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks again to Daniel Franklin for joining me on the podcast. You can order his book, Mega Change, Technology in 2050, on Amazon. Subscribe to his magazine, The Economist, and The Economist Online at theeconomist.com. Check out Daniel Franklin and his team's The World in 2017 predictions at theworldin.com and follow them on Twitter at EconWorldIn. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.